Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 87. It's Monday, November 9th. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Doing something a little bit different today. I'm recording my show on Monday rather than Friday or Saturday, because this COVID-19 pandemic is moving so quickly, I'm feeling that my local updates are getting outdated for a Tuesday or Thursday broadcast, which of course you can listen to on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, or you can listen to it online at toledoradio.org, those times live, 9 a.m. on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Well, the pandemic is raging. I was hoping, actually, maybe some good news. Sometimes the case reports actually drop over the weekend. That wasn't really the case. So let's start from the Columbus Dispatch. Anatomy of a spike. Ohio COVID-19 cases up 320% from recent low point after six record days. 8 months into the pandemic in Ohio, coronavirus continued to spread largely unchecked at a record rate, 320% higher than the numbers recorded in September. Governor Mike DeWine and health officials attribute their spiraling caseload to Ohioans grown weary of the life-altering virus, letting down their guard and their masks, particularly during informal gatherings with family and friends. Nearly 40% of all COVID-19 cases since the pandemic surfaced in Ohio on March 9th have come in the past 40 days, with the six highest daily case totals noted in the past 6 days. That's the six highest in the last 6 days, including a record 5,549 on Saturday. Hospitalizations also have reached an all-time high, with 2,286 in need of advanced care to fight off the deadly virus as of yesterday. Hospitalizations are averaging 171 a day this month, a 46% increase from October and a 142% increase from September. 72% of intensive care beds across Ohio were filled, with 13% representing coronavirus patients, a rate beneath the state goal of keeping at least 20% of ICU beds open for a spike in the seriously ill. COVID-19 deaths, the reporting of which lags behind increases in case numbers, have also increased. Ohio's averaged 26 deaths a day during November, up 73% from October's daily average of 15 fatalities a day. The spread of the virus throughout the state is reflected in the escalating percentage of coronavirus tests that come back positive. In late September, the 7-day average positivity rate stood at 2.7%, and the daily rate came in as low as 2.5%. The weekly average since has increased more than 200% to 8.4%, while the latest daily figure is three times higher at 10%. That tells you increased testing is not what is driving the increased number of cases, DeWine said. It's significant spread, unprecedented spread, we haven't seen before. And for the latest, today's new case count, just hot off the presses, 4,706 new cases. So, make that seven records in 7 days. The seven highest cases in the last 7 days. Okay, well, drilling down to Lucas County, we have gone up to an average 7-day case number of 155 cases a day. That is a 50% increase over the last 8 days. The previous high that we have in the last wave was 114. So we're at 155 weekly average today, 114 a month or so ago when we had our previous wave. Whenever we had a previous wave, that was closer to 2 months ago. Okay, well, while I've been recording this show, doing it on Monday, trying to get the latest news, I was waiting for the daily report to come in because they don't report. The Toledo Lucas County Health Department does not give a report on Saturday and Sunday, except for last week when they gave that scary Halloween report about the high viral fragments in our sewage. But with that exception, I was waiting for it, and sure enough, it came in while I was recording the first few minutes of the show. And what do we got? The most recent week from today to a week ago, we had 3,174 tests that were given and reported in Lucas County and 1,114 positives. That gives us a positivity rate of 35%, which was up from 22% the last time I reported it 9 days ago. Okay, now that's a huge leap. 22% is terrible. 35% is horrific. Now, one caveat though, the testing numbers reported are not always really, they're not always synced up. In other words, they may delay a few days or something. So when you're taking a week sampling, sometimes you miss a big dump. And actually, the week before, we had a little bit of up and a little bit of down. But if you compare that level of testing that we've done in the last week to the level of testing that I reported before, which was not quite the week before, but a little bit earlier than that, testing volume has actually gone up by about a third. So the fact is, our testing positivity rate is skyrocketing, and we're actually seeing an increase in testing, which means this epidemic is raging locally. Wow. Okay. Well, more bad news, I guess. Been watching nursing home data really closely. We had jumped up to 86 active cases last week. Well, it bumped up to 107 this most recent week reported. So it looks like we're off to the races there. It's very difficult to keep the nursing homes safe if you've got large spread in the community. And if you're looking at the positivity, which they are doing, mandated to do a fair amount of testing within the long-term care facilities, nursing homes, we've seen that rate go up quickly. The most recent positivity rate, 6.7% of those tested in nursing homes, that's both staff and residents. That has more than doubled from in just the last couple weeks or so. So we're seeing outbreaks in the nursing homes. And on that front, this from the Associated Press. Nursing home COVID-19 cases rise fourfold in surge states. Despite Trump administration efforts to erect a protective shield around nursing homes, coronavirus cases are surging within facilities in states hard hit by the latest onslaught of COVID-19. An analysis of federal data from 20 states for the Associated Press finds that new weekly cases among residents rose nearly fourfold from the end of May to late October, from 1,083 to 4,274. Resident deaths more than doubled, from 318 a week to 699 a week, according to the study by University of Chicago Health Researchers Rebecca Gorges and Tamara Konetska. Equally concerning, weekly cases among nursing home staff in surge states more than quadrupled, from 855 the week ending May 21st to 4,050 the week ending October 25th. That rings alarms because infected staffers not yet showing symptoms are seen as the most likely way for the virus to get into facilities. When those unwitting staffers test positive, they are sidelined from caring for residents, raising pressures on remaining staff. The administration has allocated $5 billion to nursing homes, shipped nearly 14,000 fast test machines with a goal of supplying every facility, and tried to shore up stocks of protective equipment. but the data call into question the broader White House game plan, one that pushes states to reopen while maintaining that vulnerable people can be cocooned, even if the virus rebounds around them. Trying to protect nursing home residents without controlling community spread is a losing battle, said Konietzka, a nationally recognized expert in long-term care. Someone has to care for vulnerable nursing home residents, and those caregivers move in and out of the nursing home daily, providing an easy pathway for the virus to enter. Nursing homes and other long-term care facilities account for 1% of the U.S. population, but represent 40% of COVID-19 deaths, according to the COVID Tracking Project. Konietzka said her research has shown that nursing home quality has no significant effect on cases and deaths once community spread is factored in. It's not like the high-quality facilities have figured out how to do things better, she said. Other academic experts have reached similar conclusions. The study, based on data reported by nursing homes to the government, also raised other concerns. For the week ending October 25th, about 1 in 6 nursing homes in surge states did not report having tests staffed the prior week. Government requirements call for staff testing at least weekly in areas where the virus is spreading. During the same period, nearly 1 in 5 nursing homes reported shortages of basic protective supplies such as masks and gowns. Also, nearly 1 in 4 facilities reported a nurse staffing shortage. If all this seems familiar, well, there we go again. The same issues we were dealing with in the first couple months of the pandemic. Okay, well, in relatively somewhat better news, looking at the surveillance from the University of Toledo, they had only 20 new positive test infections the most recent week, and that's down from 25 and some earlier weeks of 28, 27, 25, 13. So that seems to be holding relatively stable, which is good. In their largely random surveillance testing, the most recent week showed 2.2% positivity, which is not great, but it doesn't seem to be getting wildly worse. Okay, well, what about Lucas County schools, your K through 12 schools, public and private? Well, we bumped up to 47 staff and 53 students showing new infections. That 47 staff and 53 students is up from 29 staff and 29 students the week before. And of course, this is largely going to depend on what the community rate is. If you have it in the community traveling around, well, it's going to affect people in the school community. Although it does seem that if you take good measures in the school, you can prevent a lot of the transmission in the actual school facilities. So in fact, some students and staff perhaps may be actually safer in the school environment than they are actually out in the community, but because they go back and forth, well, there you go. Okay, well, let's do another little check-in at the state level. This from the Cincinnati Inquirer. Coronavirus in Ohio. DeWine names new state health director. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine appointed Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation Administrator Stephanie McLeod to lead the Ohio Department of Health, which has gone without a permanent director for months. McLeod will take over as the state continues to break records for new novel coronavirus cases heading into winter, which is expected to exacerbate the disease. Unlike her predecessor, Dr. Amy Acton, McLeod is not a doctor. She holds a journalism degree from Ohio University and a law degree from Capital University Law School. Ohio law requires the state health director to be either a physician or someone with, quote, significant experience in the public health profession, end of quote. DeWine previously prioritized finding a doctor with public health experience to lead the department. Now, he says, Ohio is in a different stage of fighting the disease and needs someone who can focus on administration. Of course, he did a wonderful job trying to pull together some small levels of experience to count to meet that state requirement. They have significant experience in the public health profession, but clearly he's going a different way of not taking a health expert and taking a more traditional administrator. Okay, well, looking at a federal level, we see that with the election over, at least in the minds of many, we are seeing a big disparity in the partisan divide. This from Associated Press. Counties with worst virus surges overwhelmingly voted Trump. U.S. voters went to the polls starkly divided on how they see Donald Trump's response to the coronavirus pandemic. But in places where the virus is most rampant now, Trump enjoyed enormous support. An Associated Press analysis reveals that in 376 counties with the highest number of new cases per capita, the overwhelming majority, 93% of those counties, went for Trump, a rate above other less severely hit areas. Most were rural counties in Montana, the Dakotas, Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, and Wisconsin, the kind of areas that often have lower rates of adherence to social distancing, mask wearing, and other public health measures, and have been a focal point for much of the latest surge in cases. Taking note of the contrast, state health officials are pausing for a moment of introspection. Even as they worry about rising numbers of hospitalizations and deaths, they hope to reframe their message and aim for a reset on public sentiment now that the election is over. Public health officials need to step back, listen to, and understand the people who aren't taking the same stance on mask wearing and other control measures, said Dr. Marcus Plescia of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. I think there's the potential for things to get less charged and divisive, he said, adding that there's a chance of a retooled public health message that might unify Americans around lowering case counts so hospitals don't get swamped during the winter months. The electoral divide comes amid an explosion of cases and hospitalizations in the U.S. and globally. 36% of Trump voters described the pandemic as completely or mostly under control, and another 47% said it was somewhat under control, according to AP VoteCast, a nationwide survey of more than 110,000 voters. Meanwhile, 82% of Biden voters said the pandemic is not at all under control. Trump voters interviewed by AP reporters said they value individual freedom and believe the president was doing as well as anyone could in response to the coronavirus. About half of Trump voters called the economy and jobs the top issue facing the nation, roughly twice the percentage who named the pandemic, according to VoteCast. By contrast, a majority of Biden voters, about 6 in 10, said the pandemic was the most important issue. The political temperature has added to the stress of public health officials. Our biggest concern is how long can they sustain this pace, Plescia said. Since the start of the pandemic, 74 state and local public health officials in 31 states have resigned, retired, or been fired, according to an ongoing analysis by AP and the Kaiser Health News. As the election mood dissipates, rising hospitalizations amid colder weather create a really pivotal moment in the pandemic, said Seema Sagyar, executive director of the Surrogo Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit that works with Harvard University-affiliated Aradigm Labs to develop a tool for estimating vaccine needs in states. We really need to get our act together. When I say we, I mean collectively, Sagyar said. Finding common ground may become easier if one or more of the vaccine candidates prove safe and effective and gains government approval, she said. The vaccine provides the reset button, she said. Dr. Anthony Fauci may be another unifying force. According to VoteCast, 73% of voters nationwide approve of the way Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, has been handling the pandemic. Even among Trump voters, 53% approve of Fauci's performance. About 9 in 10 Biden voters approve. Okay, well, taking a look at the international scene as well, this from Associated Press. UN summit in December to push action on COVID-19 pandemic. The United Nations voted to hold a summit on the COVID-19 pandemic on December 3rd through 4th to press for action on the global spread of the coronavirus and its unprecedented effects on societies, economies, jobs, global trade, and travel. The General Assembly voted 150-0, with only the United States, Israel, and Armenia abstaining, on a resolution authorizing the meeting and spelling out arrangements. It will include pre-recorded speeches by world leaders and a discussion led by the World Health Organization chief. Assembly President Volkan Bozkır called the high-level special session a historic moment and a test for multilateralism that will be defined by our collective action on one of the most critical issues of our time. If anything, it is a belated first step, he said. This is a time for action. Action in memory of the souls lost to COVID-19. Action to protect the most vulnerable people who are depending upon us. And action to safeguard our futures. Let us not forget that none of us are safe until we are all safe. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said in an interview with the Associated Press in late October that it was very frustrating that leaders of the 20 major industrialized nations, known as the G20, didn't come together in March and establish a coordinated response to suppress the coronavirus in all countries. Instead, he said, they went their own ways as infection moved every way, everywhere. The UN chief recalled that at the March meeting, he urged adoption of a wartime plan, including a stimulus package in the trillions of dollars for businesses, workers, and households in developing countries trying to tackle the pandemic, and a task force to have a combined effort to defeat the virus. The G20 is holding a virtual summit on November 21st and 22nd, and Guterres said the United States will be strongly advocating for better coordination and seeking a guarantee that any coronavirus vaccine is treated as a global public good and be made available and affordable to everyone everywhere. The resolution adopted recognizes the need for a global response to the pandemic that is people-centered, gender-responsive, with full respect for human rights, multidimensional, coordinated, inclusive, and innovative, based on unity, solidarity, and multilateral cooperation. Okay, well, next up, a few updates on the scientific status of coronavirus. This from Science Daily. Face masks don't hinder breathing during exercise, study finds. A new University of Saskatchewan study has found that exercise performance and blood and muscle oxygen levels are not affected for healthy individuals wearing a face mask during strenuous workouts. Questions have been raised as to whether mask wearing during vigorous exercise might compromise oxygen intake or increase the rebreathing of carbon dioxide, leading to a condition whereby increased carbon dioxide displaces oxygen in the blood. But the study, published in the research journal International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health, did not find evidence to support these concerns. This is important when fitness centers open up during the COVID-19 epidemic, since respiratory droplets may be propelled further with heavy breathing during vigorous exercise, and because of reports of COVID-19 clusters in crowded enclosed exercise facilities. The study evaluated use using a three-layer cloth face mask.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, next up from the Hill. CDC says pregnant women with COVID-19 at increased risk for serious outcomes. Pregnant women are at increased risk for severe illness and might give birth prematurely if they get COVID-19, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Reports released by the CDC indicate that pregnant women are at significantly higher risk for severe outcomes from COVID-19 compared to women who aren't pregnant. Still, the report stressed the overall risk to pregnant women with COVID-19 of serious illness or pregnancy complications remains low. About 10.5 out of 1,000 pregnant women were admitted to ICUs compared to 3.9 out of 1,000 non-pregnant women, with adjustments made for differences in age, race, ethnicity, and underlying health conditions. Pregnant women with COVID-19 are also more likely to give birth prematurely than pregnant women who aren't infected with the disease, according to the CDC. A separate analysis published by the CDC found that pregnant women with COVID-19 were at increase for giving birth prematurely. In a sample of 3,900 infants born to women with COVID-19 infections, 13% were preterm, compared to the national estimate of 10% in the general population. However, the full impact of infection in pregnancy is still largely unknown, the authors wrote. Okay, well, this next story is an example of where you may go forward two steps and back one, or forward one step and back two, depending how it works out. So this from Stat News, the hidden public health hazard of rapid COVID-19 tests. Rapid COVID-19 tests are being deployed by the millions across the nation. The federal government is sending these tests, which can provide results in minutes, to states for educators, students, nursing home patients, first responders, and other sites. That's a good thing. But in a rush to get individual test results, we're making a dangerous public health mistake. We're losing critical data about COVID-19. For months, the U.S. has struggled to get accurate information about COVID-19 cases and testing about different demographic groups. As rapid tests surge and are performed at sites that don't follow specific COVID-19 data reporting processes, even more information will be lost. Accurate data are essential for fighting public health crises like COVID-19. Policymakers need complete, timely information about who is getting the disease to track its spread, identify hotspots, and form effective, equitable solutions. Without data, public health strategies will be haphazard and ineffective. The COVID-19 pandemic has been a data horror story from the beginning. For months, Americans struggled to get COVID-19 tests, leaving cases of the infection undetected. The data that did exist were woefully incomplete, often lacking information important like a patient's race and ethnicity. Data collection has improved since then, but is still lacking. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website has race and ethnicity data only for half of COVID-19 cases. And the Trump administration is under investigation for tampering with the CDC's COVID-19 reports. Without significant changes, rapid tests will make this data deficit worse. Laboratories are required to provide extensive data to accompany COVID-19 tests. According to federal guidance published in June, they must collect and report for each test demographic information such as the patient's age, race, ethnicity, sex, and zip code. Those are sound reporting requirements, but thousands upon thousands of testing sites nationwide are beginning to operate outside of laboratory facilities and are not equipped to comply with state and federal reporting regulations. That includes the vast majority of nursing homes, major hotspots for COVID-19, as well as many urgent care and physicians' offices. It also includes unconventional sites like community testing pop-ups. So a site could test hundreds of people in a day and not report comprehensive data to local and federal officials. And if reporting does occur, it could take a while to be entered into a digitized system. That means missing crucial data, particularly information on racial inequities. Gaps in data reporting will become more common in the months to come. Rapid at-home COVID-19 tests that give on-the-spot results will soon hit the market. These tests provide immediate results, but it's unknown if they will require people to report their results or demographic information to health departments. That means we could lose millions of data points about COVID-19. To be sure, quick test results are critically important to combat COVID-19, but those tests should come with a requirement to report comprehensive, accurate data back to local or state public health agencies. We should be moving forward on data collection efforts, not backward. Fortunately, several legislators and organizations are leading the way. Senator Elizabeth Warren and Representative Ayanna Pressley, for example, and others have proposed several bills aimed for accurate, timely data collection. The Data Elemental to Health campaign aims to secure $100 million in federal funding over 10 years for the CDC and state and local, tribal, and territorial health departments to modernize health data and create a more effective data system for public health. We must stop at nothing to get accurate data about the results of COVID-19 tests and other aspects of the pandemic. Otherwise, we will lose our battle against it. Okay, well, I want to close out today's COVID-19 coverage with a relatively long, in-depth article about some of the psychology of trying to deal with the pandemic, particularly since we are very divided. But this is actually even a more basic article about just how difficult it is to communicate and incorporate risk into decision-making in our everyday lives. This from ProPublica. How your brain tricks you into taking risks during the pandemic. It was mid-February and Maria Konnikova, a psychologist, writer, and champion poker player, was on a multi-city trip. From her hotel room in New Orleans, she called her sister, a doctor, to discuss the emerging COVID-19 pandemic. Konnikova saw that there were early cases in Los Angeles where she was headed for a poker tournament. The odds of Konnikova getting infected or spreading a virus by participating in a large indoor event were unknown. But as a poker player, she had a lot of experience thinking through the probable risks associated with different decisions. so she played it conservatively. She cut short her trip and went home to quarantine in New York. Konnikova's psychology expertise tells her that most people have a hard time thinking through the uncertainty and probabilities posed by the pandemic. People tend to learn through experience, and we've never lived through anything like COVID-19. Every day, people face unpleasant and uncertain risks associated with their behavior, and that ambiguity goes against how we tend to think. The brain likes certainty, she said. The brain likes black and white. It wants clear answers and wants clear cause and effect. It doesn't like living in a world of ambiguities and gray zones. Many months into the pandemic, even as the nation faces its highest average of daily case counts to date, people still don't agree on how to live in the era of COVID-19. We know how to protect ourselves, washing our hands, wearing masks, and staying socially distant, but many people still take unnecessary risks, even at the highest levels of government. In late September, the White House hosted an indoor party celebrating the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. It became a possible superspreader event because attendees did not wear masks and ignored social distancing recommendations. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie didn't wear a mask at the event. He also went without one when he helped President Donald Trump prepare for his first debate. Christie later spent a week in intensive care with COVID-19 and then wrote an opinion article in the Wall Street Journal titled, "I Should Have Worn a Mask. I Let My Guard Down," he wrote. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention called on Americans to wear masks in July. So why is it so hard for people to mask up and practice other established behaviors to prevent the spread of COVID-19? The problem, experts who study the way we think says, is that the unprecedented nature of the pandemic makes us vulnerable to subtle biases that undermine how we process information and assess risk. Our brains can play tricks on us. That causes some people to underestimate their risk, the expert said. When Las Vegas reopened, crowds showed up without masks. An estimated 365,000 people attended the annual Sturgis Motorcycle Rally in South Dakota. Many didn't wear helmets or masks. The festivities included a non-socially distanced concert by Smash Mouth. And even though masks were distributed and required at a recent Trump rally in Erie, Pennsylvania, some attendees did not wear them, and the campaign packed people into crowded buses. It may not always seem like it, but people are rational and weigh the costs and benefits when they make decisions, said Eve Wittenberg, a decision scientist at the Center for Health Decision Science at the Harvard School of Public Health. People are not stupid here, she said, but they have no experience thinking through a pandemic and are also getting mixed and conflicted messages from leaders, she said. That creates uncertainty and can lead people to rely on patterns of risk perception that may not be accurate. The power of social norms and personal experience. People may be more likely to participate in riskier activities because they tend to behave according to the norms that surround them, said Lisa Robinson, a senior research scientist at the Center for Health Decision Science. If we're surrounded by people who behave a certain way, she said, we are more likely to behave the same way. At this point, the facts about COVID-19 are well established. It's extremely contagious and transmitted via droplets that come from an infected person's mouth or nose. This can happen during speech, coughing, sneezing, or breathing, whether a person is experiencing symptoms or not. Older and sicker people are at higher risk of serious illness or death, but young, healthy people can still become infected and sick, and they can also put others at risk by spreading the virus. A well-known historical example of people being directed by social norms is smoking, Robinson said. For decades, a societal norm was smoking was cool, even after it was known to kill people. That contributed to a lot of people smoking, willing to take the risk. Then the norm flipped and smoking became uncool, and fewer people smoked. We take a lot of cues from our environment, Robinson said. If I see a lot of people wearing masks, I wear a mask. Betsy Palick, a professor of psychology and public policy at Princeton University and a MacArthur Genius Fellow, studies how these social norms are formed and how they shift over time. There's a lot of competing information out there, Palick said. Your individual decisions are very real to you, of course, but they need to be validated by other people in your neighborhood or your organization. Palick said everyone is influenced by social norms, including her. She has a newborn and elderly parents, so she's been cautious during the pandemic, but it's getting harder to be careful as people broaden their social lives. She talked recently to a friend who is holding her kids out of school, opting for all virtual instruction. The friend's decision felt like a huge relief because it affirmed Palick's own feelings. It showed her how much we all rely on a shared reality. Holding the line on your own is just not tenable, she said. Personal experience has also an outsized role in decision-making. People who were in the hot zones of New York City and New Jersey during the initial spread of COVID-19 witnessed the effects of the virus. They may have become infected themselves or known others who became sick or even died. They might have known healthcare workers who cared for the sick, potentially exposing themselves in the process. Meanwhile, people in parts of the country that have not been hit hard by the virus might not have had the experience and therefore fail to appreciate the risk. Poker players, along with folks like meteorologists, horse race handicappers, and lawyers who work on a contingency basis, are routinely rewarded or punished based on the odds. This gives them a rare visceral experiential understanding of percentages and lets them short-circuit a cognitive effect called the description experience gap, which leads people to underestimate risk based on their own personal experiences. Even Nobel Prize-winning economists are susceptible to it. The pandemic is beyond the limits of human intuition, said a psychologist and economist Daniel Kahneman on Konnikova's podcast. Wittenberg pointed to the work of Kahneman and Amos Tversky, who coined the term availability to describe how we base our thinking on what we've seen or experienced. We see it show up when a person assesses his or her risk of a heart attack by recalling instances among acquaintances, the two researchers wrote in their 1974 paper, Judgment Under Uncertainty. The researchers also noted how some instances might come to mind more easily than others and thus get more heavily weighted in decision-making. Other instances might be more salient or may have happened more frequently, so they tend to come to mind faster. Relying on availability to make decisions introduces biases, according to Kahneman and Tversky. It is a common experience that the subjective probability of traffic accidents rises temporarily when one sees a car overturned by the side of the road, the researchers wrote. The need for leaders and institutions to guide us. The confusion surrounding COVID-19 was magnified by a lack of testing in the early days of the pandemic and then delays in test results, Wittenberg said. That meant people didn't have clear data to anchor their risk assessment. The confusion called for leaders to guide the public with clear public health messages, but instead they have exacerbated the problems. It was well known relatively early in the pandemic that wearing a mask could help prevent the spread of the virus, but it took until July before Trump wore one in public for the first time. Some governors have downplayed the risk posed by the virus, others have emphasized it. That's left the public grappling with mixed and conflicted messages. Barak Fischhoff, a psychologist who studies risks and decision-making at Carnegie Mellon University, said people are good at perceiving risk if they are getting information from a trustworthy source, but the risks associated with the coronavirus, which is invisible, are not intuitive, he said. It's hard for people to project the exponential spread of the virus, he said. Our minds don't easily extrapolate it, so we need leaders to help protect us from ourselves, he said. The situation could be compared to how the government protects people at train crossings, Fischhoff said. Drivers are good at estimating the speed of other cars, but research from accidents at train crossings has shown that drivers are not good at estimating the speed of oncoming trains, which are much bigger. Our brains are calibrated to treat a train like a car, he said, but it's going faster than it looks. To stay safe from an oncoming train, drivers either need to go against their intuition, have someone warn them in a way that they will remember, or have something block the crossing when a train approaches. Somebody needs to protect you, he said. Good public health communication requires testing messages to make sure they are interpreted correctly by a wide range of people, Fischhoff said. Our official communicators have dropped the ball, and they have been undermined by people who don't have the public interests at heart, he said. Palak, the social psychologist, said certain leaders and influencers stick out like bright colors. They're charismatic, and we look to them when we check our own behavior. What they say and do becomes the anchor we use, she said. People also put faith in trustworthy institutions, he said, even when they may not agree with what the institution is saying. She and a colleague found something surprising when they studied the effect of the Supreme Court legalizing same-sex marriage. A greater number of people supported same-sex marriage because of the Supreme Court decision, even if they had not changed their personal views. They thought that there was a bigger consensus in the United States that same-sex marriage was a good thing, Palak said. So that's the power of an institution. Optimism bias and why institutions failed to act. Optimism bias is a pattern of thinking that causes our brains to see future outcomes as rosier than they really are. It transcends gender, culture, and age. It turns out to be incredibly helpful in most situations. There's only one subset of the population that doesn't experience optimism bias, Konnikova said, people suffering from depression. This is actually something that's very psychologically protective, she said. It ends up that seeing the world as it is makes you clinically depressed. When it comes to institutional behavior, however, optimism bias can lead to poor planning and risky decision making. Dr. Eric Toner is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and says that the pandemic has taught him about the power of denial. The global public health community learned in mid-January about the extent of community transmission of the novel coronavirus in Wuhan, China. The most obvious sign of concern, he said, came when China took the dramatic step of locking down Wuhan, one of its largest cities. Something really bad is happening, he thought to himself. And yet, public health officials in the United States were slow to sound an alarm. People have trouble recognizing when they're facing a catastrophic threat, and on the other hand, they exaggerate minor threats, Toner said. We needed messaging from the top of the government that says this is a serious threat. Until you hear the message from somebody who's in a position of authority, I think there's a tendency to really want to not believe it. People don't want to believe really bad news. Toner said the Center for Health Security heard over and over again that hospital CEOs would not be convinced of the dire threat posed by the pandemic until the federal government decided to say something. But by then, much time had been lost. When public health officials did sound an early alarm, their voices were squelched. Dr. Nancy Messonnier, one of the senior leaders at the CDC, warned on February 25th that there would be community spread of the virus and that protective measures might include school closures and working from home. As ProPublica previously reported, her comments caused the stock market to drop, which infuriated Trump. Vice President Mike Pence was installed as communicator-in-chief, and the CDC officials were sidelined. When it mattered most, they shut us up, a senior CDC official told ProPublica. Toner's group is in charge of designing pandemic preparedness exercises. Some of them are eerily similar to our current situation. He said he's often asked how it's possible that we did all these exercises and still had such a bad response to the COVID-19 pandemic. His answer? The exercises advanced the field, but they had their limits. They didn't inoculate us against really bad decision-making, he said. Okay, well, in my ongoing effort to reopen the show to non-COVID-19 news, got some stories here. This from Kaiser Health News. Medicare fines half of hospitals for readmitting too many patients. Nearly half the nation's hospitals, many of which are still wrestling with the financial fallout of the unexpected coronavirus, will get lower payments for all Medicare patients because of their history of readmitting patients, federal records show. The penalties are the ninth annual round of the hospital's readmissions reduction program, created as part of the Affordable Care Act's broader effort to improve quality and lower costs. The latest penalties are calculated using each hospital case history between July 2016 and June 2019. So the flood of coronavirus patients that have swamped hospitals this year were not included. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services announced in September it may suspend the penalty program in the future if the chaos surrounding the pandemic, including the spring's moratorium on elective surgeries, makes it too difficult to assess hospital performance. For this year, the penalties remain in effect. Retroactive to the federal fiscal year that began October 1st, Medicare will lower a year's worth of payments to 2,545 hospitals, the data show. The average reduction is 0.7%, with 613 hospitals receiving a penalty of 1% or more. Out of 5,267 hospitals in the country, Congress has exempted 2,176 from the threat of penalties, either because they are critical access hospitals, defined as the only inpatient facility in an area, or hospitals that specialize in psychiatric patients, children, veterans, rehabilitation, or long-term care. Of the 3,080 hospitals the Center for Medicaid Services evaluated, 83% received a penalty. The number and severity of penalties were comparable to those of recent years, although the numbers of hospitals receiving the maximum penalty of 3% dropped from 56 to 39. Because the penalties are applied to new admission payments, the total dollar amount each hospital will lose will not be known until after the fiscal year ends on July 30th of next year. The penalties are based on readmissions of Medicare patients who initially came to the hospital with diagnoses of congestive heart failure, heart attack, pneumonia, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, hip or knee replacement, or coronary artery bypass graft surgery. Medicare counts as a readmission any of those patients who ended up back in any hospital within 30 days of discharge, except for planned returns like a second phase of surgery. A hospital will be penalized if its readmission rate is higher than expected given the national trends in any one of these categories. Michael Millinson, a health quality consultant who focuses on patient safety, said the penalties are a useful but imperfect mechanism to push hospitals to improve their care. The designers of the penalty system envisioned it as a way to neutralize the economic benefit hospitals get from readmitted patients under Medicare's fee-for-service payment model, as they are otherwise paid for two stays instead of just one. Yeah, well, and put in more simpler terms, if you don't do the job right first, you actually make more money by having the person readmitted. So it sets up a perverse financial incentive, which, of course, money makes the world go round, and particularly in the healthcare world, we know that. But it's also an important indicator of the quality of the services you're getting in the first place. If you do it right the first time, you will not have to do it again nearly as often. So if you're not doing as good as should be expected, then you get an adjustment in your payment. Okay, and some better news, an improvement in the healthcare system. This from Associated Press. More U.S. patients to have easy, free access to doctor's notes. More U.S. patients will soon have free electronic access to their notes their doctors write about them under a new federal requirement for transparency. Many health systems are opening up their records today, the original deadline. At the last minute, federal health officials gave an extension until April because of the coronavirus pandemic. So what's changing? Patients have long had a right to their medical records, including doctor's notes, but obtaining them could mean filling out requests, waiting for a response, and paying fees. A 2016 law said delays and barriers must be removed. If you already use a patient portal such as MyChart to email your doctor or schedule an appointment, you may soon see new options allowing you to view your doctor's notes and see your test results as soon as they are available. You may get an email explaining where to look, how to share access with a caregiver, and how to keep others' eyes off your information. Many people won't notice a change. About 15% of healthcare systems already are letting patients read doctor notes online without charge. That means about 53 million patients already have access to their doctor's notes. Will this help me? Studies have shown that patients who read their notes understand more about their health, take their medications as prescribed more often, and feel more in control of their care. Will I understand the jargon? You may have to look up terms or ask your doctor to translate at your next visit. And doctor's notes tend to use abbreviations. SOB means short of breath. By the way, BS can mean bowel sounds. Are there exceptions? Psychotherapy notes don't need to be shared with patients, and doctors can hold back a note if they think it will cause physical harm, such as a note about domestic violence if the abuser has access to the patient's health information. As for parent access to teenagers' information, state laws vary. That means some health systems allow parents to see at least some of their teenagers' notes while others do not. Parents can check with their children's doctor to find out how it works in their state. What do doctors think? Some doctors worry this will mean more phone calls from confused patients. Dr. Marlene Millen of UC San Diego Health, which launched a pilot program for primary care physicians in 2018, said that's not her experience. I did not get a big bump in questions at all, Millen said. Many patients aren't interested in their notes and never read them, she said. Others do, but save her time because they arrive for appointments and already know what the next step in the plan is because they've read the prior note. Okay, next up, an update on prevention recommendations. This from The Hill. Colon cancer screening should begin at age 45, not 50, U.S. Task Force says. A key panel of experts recommended for the first time that people get screened for colorectal cancer starting at age 45 instead of age 50, pointing to new evidence of cancer in younger people. The recommendation from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force comes after American Cancer Society recommended the same age change in 2018. The draft recommendation is open to public comment until November 23rd. The task force especially recommended the earlier screening for black patients, given higher rates of disease among black people. Colorectal cancer is the third leading cause of cancer death in the United States, but about a quarter of people aged 50 to 75, the age range which the previous guidelines for screening have not been screened, according to the panel. So even with the old guidelines, a lot of people aren't getting screened. Unfortunately, not enough people in the U.S. receive this effective preventive service that has been proven to save lives, Alex Crist, the chair of the task force, said in a statement. We hope that this recommendation to screen people ages 45 to 75 for colorectal cancer will encourage more screening and reduce people's risk of dying from this disease. Okay, next up, from The Nation's Health, the newspaper of the American Public Health Association. CDC says 1/3 of people with a disability experience mental distress. People with disabilities often get lost in the conversation on health equity. A recent federal study helps fill in the gaps by sharing important data on their mental health. An estimated 17.4 million U.S. adults with disabilities, or 33%, experience mental distress 4 or 5 times more often than the rest of the U.S. population, according to a study in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Over half of adults with cognitive and mobility disabilities reported mental distress, which is often undiagnosed. Healthcare providers caring for adults with disabilities might focus on the primary disability as a cause for a behavior and mental health symptom, rather than considering the possibility that that person may have an undiagnosed co-occurring mental disorder, Robin Cree, PhD and epidemiologist with CDC's National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities and lead author of the study, told The Nation's Health. CDC researchers analyzed 2018 behavioral risk factor surveillance system data on over 400,000 adults, both with and without disabilities. Frequent mental distress was defined as having 14 or more mentally unhealthy days in the past month. Adults with disabilities often report mental distress because they are unable to afford the health care they need, the study researchers said. Mental distress was also linked to adverse health behaviors and conditions such as smoking or insomnia. To help improve the mental health of people with disabilities, health providers should promote healthy behaviors such as exercise, maintaining a healthy weight, and avoiding tobacco and alcohol, study researchers suggested. But many times, healthcare workers do not recommend healthy habits to people with disabilities, according to Mackenzie Jones, an education specialist at the Montana Department of Public Health and Resources, who was not part of the study. That oversight can increase risk of chronic health conditions and contribute to mental distress. Without referrals or access to mental health services, let alone services that are culturally sensitive to people with disability, isolation and hopelessness can occur, creating a deeper challenge and leading to mental illness, Jones said. Cree said public health professionals should include people with disabilities in their evidence-based programs to address mental health disparities. Programs with increased social cohesion, encourage community participation, improve access to quality mental health screening and care, and promote healthy lifestyle recommendations can help reduce mental distress among people with disabilities. Ivan Moulton, an associate professor of psychology and rehabilitation medicine at the University of Washington, said that wraparound approaches in which patients receive individualized health coaching, socialization planning, and psychological aid have been shown to work. But Moulton cautioned not to accept the myth that people with disabilities are generally lonely, socially isolated, or depressed. This can become an unhelpful caricature, said Moulton, who was not part of the CDC study. 1/3 of people with a disability report frequent mental distress, but 2/3 do not, which is not to dismiss the need for better mental health supports, but rather to emphasize the resilience of this population. Okay, I want to close out with a story near and dear to my heart as a public health nutritionist, this from Stat News. Make America healthy again by paying more attention to nutrition. Healthcare and healthcare policy were centerpieces of the 2020 presidential and congressional campaigns. It's a shame that neither party focused on the underlying issue, the poor health of the American people, largely attributed to poor nutrition. By many measures, the population of the United States is the unhealthiest of any high-income country, despite spending much more money as a share of the economy on healthcare. The incidence of chronic disease is higher, and life expectancy is lower. COVID-19 has magnified the effects of America's poor health. Those living with chronic disease are more likely to be hospitalized and to die with COVID-19 than those in better health. A recent report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showed that 94% of those who have died from COVID-19 had an average of 2.6 additional conditions. A report in the Journal of the American Medical Association showed that since May 10th, the U.S. has had the highest per capita death rate from COVID-19 and other causes among 18 other high-income countries. The health of Americans has been in decline for years. The tragedy is not that the U.S. is losing a contest with other countries, concluded the authors of the 2013 report sponsored by the National Institutes of Health, but that Americans are dying and suffering from illness and injury at rates that are demonstrably unnecessary. There are complex factors between the U.S.'s high premature death rate, but it is a mistake to believe that the country's abominable health outcomes are highly dependent on, say, preserving or repealing the Affordable Care Act. That's because the U.S. healthcare system is really a sick care system that treats people after their health has declined. Many chronic conditions plaguing Americans, such as obesity, diabetes, and high blood pressure, are avoidable with a prudent diet and lifestyle. Today, more than 42% of American adults have obesity, as do 19% of children of age 19 and under. The U.S. has the world's 12th highest obesity rate after Kuwait. The top 10 are all small Pacific Island nations. Diet makes a difference. Nearly half of all deaths in the U.S. from heart disease, stroke, and type 2 diabetes are associated with diet, such as the overconsumption of processed meats and sugar-sweetened beverages and insufficient intake of fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. And cancer? Among individuals who don't smoke, avoidance of overweight is the most important strategy for cancer prevention, according to a 2004 review of evidence regarding diet, nutrition, and the prevention of cancer. Obesity poses a preeminent threat to the health of Americans, and the stakes for tackling it have never been greater. Those who contract COVID-19 and have obesity, especially young people, face an elevated risk of complications and death. There is a clear need for action, particularly from Washington. Here are a few suggestions for the next administration. Refocus federal research on nutrition. The NIH has a budget of nearly $42 billion to fund research devoted to protecting and improving health. But none of NIH's 27 institutes or centers devotes research strictly to nutrition. The next administration can deliver a long-term boost to nutrition research by working with Congress to create a new research institute focused on the health effects of the foods we eat. Make healthy food more affordable and unhealthy food less affordable. The average American consumes less than one serving of fruit daily, but nearly twice as many servings of sugar-sweetened beverages. Researchers at the Friedman School of Nutrition Sciences and Policy at Tufts University projected that a 30% reduction in the price of fruits and vegetables and a corresponding increase in the price of red meat and sugary drinks would prevent an estimated 63,000 deaths each year. The next administration should explore subsidizing fruits and vegetables to make them less expensive and taxing the unhealthy products that contribute to obesity. Teach doctors about nutrition. Americans say they have a high level of trust in doctors when it comes to nutrition, even though less than 1% of medical school lecture hours are devoted to nutrition, and much of that limited focus time is on complex biochemistry. Maybe it shouldn't be a surprise that in a survey of 12,000 doctors conducted last year by the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, just 15% said they feel totally prepared to offer nutritional guidance to their patients. The next administration should work with medical schools to incorporate more nutrition education into their curricula. Give recipients of federal nutrition assistance programs incentives to consume healthy foods. People with low incomes are more likely to have obesity than those with high incomes. While there are myriad reasons for this, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, is one of the culprits. This federal nutrition program places no limits on food and beverage items that beneficiaries can purchase, and a USDA report shows that about 20 cents of every SNAP dollar is spent on sweetened beverages, dessert, salty snacks, candy, and sugar. There are ways to change that. In 2011 and 12, the USDA launched a pilot project in Hamden County, Massachusetts, in which SNAP participants were given an extra 30 cents for every dollar of assistance if the money was spent on selected fruits and vegetables at participating retailers. The effect? Consumption of fruits and vegetables was 26% higher among those in the pilot project than among those who weren't. This model should become a future of SNAP nationwide. Use the bully pulpit. The future president should speak about the perils of the standard American diet, sometimes abbreviated fiddly as SAD. The administration should also pressure food and beverage companies, the restaurant sector, and supermarkets to exercise greater responsibility regarding the products they produce and sell, and perhaps dangle threats of the advertising limits now faced by the tobacco and spirits industries. A healthier eating campaign would bump up against the challenge of changing unhealthy behaviors, but change is possible. Take another public health issue once thought to be insurmountable, smoking. In 1964, about 42% of American adults were smokers. Today, that figure is below 14%. Leaders of both parties need to recognize the strong connection between poor dietary patterns and the nation's worsening health, a function of the majority of Americans being both overfed with unhealthy foods and undernourished with healthier ones. Hippocrates, the father of modern medicine, had it right when he wrote, "Let food be thy medicine and medicine thy food." If that idea can spread, and if eating habits can improve, we'll be on the road to making America healthy again. Well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. You can queue up future shows or re-listen to this show or previous shows by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.